Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Hey, it's 12:03 on Thursday afternoon, September 19th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. The interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve could change the housing market. We'll talk about the impact in our next segment, but right now there's a lot going on that can impact the economy, including but not limited to the rate cut by the Fed and the race for the White House. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home is, well, you've heard his commercials on WBBM, Bill Geiger, founder and president of Geiger Wealth Management in Oak Brook. Bill, thank you for joining us today. And a lot of questions people have, not only just as we head into election season, but just what this interest rate cut means for them. And that is, Bill, if you are carrying debt right now, whether it's credit card debt or some other line of debt, will you see that interest rate cut immediately, or is it going to take some time to work its way through?
Rob, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's nice to be with you. And to answer your question, it's probably going to take a little while to work its way through. What's a little bit more concerning to me is the size of this interest rate cut. Wall Street was expecting a 0.25% decrease. The Fed lowered 0.5%. And what that says to me, after doing this for over 40 years, is either the Fed is playing politics, or they're more nervous, they're more concerned about the economy going forward. In other words, things are worse than what we thought.
And that brings up brings us into the much larger discussion about just kind of the uncertainty that's swirling on a day-to-day basis, because on one day on the Noon Business Hour, we could be talking about data points and reports that point to a strong economy, and then 24 hours later, we could be talking about weakness in certain sectors that could be pointing to a much weaker economy. So, Bill, on a daily basis, if you're concerned about your job and your savings, how should you process all of this information?
Well, let me kind of give you a little background in this. As I mentioned, I've done this for 40 years. I have never seen couples more upset and more nervous in a presidential cycle in all those 40 years. And especially if folks are in their late 50s to early 60s, they're 5 to 10 years from retirement, and they can't afford a big loss. They're happy about the market going up, but they're really, really concerned about a big loss at this stage. And the market and politics are not conducive to them relaxing at any time soon.
Well, I just think generally the mood in the country, just because there's just so much stimuli, Bill, that in the old days, Election Day was a Tuesday and that's it. And then Now Election Day is trench warfare, online combat with, you know, someone you went to high school with 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you can't escape it if you wanted to. And that's why people are so tense. At least that's my belief. So if you step away from that and you just look at the numbers, you know, when do the markets begin to notice Election Day is going to be here? And how long does it take for them to process any potential policy changes once a candidate wins?
Well, that's going to play out on a day-to-day basis. One other fact that is going on is we've had two attempted presidential assassinations, and which is something that I've never seen in my lifetime. And it is just upsetting everybody. And nobody knows exactly what the policy changes are going to be. Nobody knows exactly how everything's going to play out and how long it's going to take to play out. So there's a lot of uncertainty.
Bill Geiger, founder and president, Geiger Wealth Management in Oak Brook. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, what the Fed rate cut means for the housing market.
The only program dedicated to currency events. You're listening to the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The much-anticipated rate cut by the Federal Reserve is expected to strongly impact the housing market over the long term. Let's talk about what lies ahead with Drew Wishover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago. Drew, thank you for joining us today. Now, is this a situation where realtors across the Chicago area are just going to put that sign up on the front lawn of a home for sale and just see a line of people out the door because finally they're jumping into the housing market?
Yeah, that's funny, Rob. I was just coming off of a cartwheel and a couple flips because it's been 4 years, my man. It has been 4 years since they've cut these rates, 2020. So here we are today, you know, kind of being, you know, excited about this you know, half point basis point cut. And really, what is that going to mean? I think we started to see it as I talked, you know, last time you guys had me on. We started to see it then. There was starting to anticipate that this was going to happen. So there was kind of an influx in, you know, refinances. But now that it's actually happened, I think it's going to take a little bit of time. And then there's still more anticipation that they're going to cut it a couple more times before the end of the year. And there, you know, there's an election coming up, somebody told me, so that'll affect this and impact it. So I think there's a couple things that we're still going to kind of keep an eye out for, but yes, this certainly is a relief to a lot of us.
Also, this is an interesting time to cut interest rates, because the last time the Fed cut rates by a meaningful amount, it was in the midst of an economic crisis. I mean, we were talking about the Fed cutting interest rates back in the spring of 2020, and then before that in 2007, 2008. And even though there was a pickup in economic activity in 2020 that got a lot of people into homes at low prices, I mean, nobody was buying a house in 2008 or 2009. So we have to go back to the 90s to see a time in which interest rates were cut during a period of strong economic activity. And what was it like back then, if you were around for that? And are there any lessons we could learn today?
Well, thanks for making me old. I appreciate you for that. So we're going to go ahead and say that, you know, you may not know this, but I factually do, that the interest rates were double digits. And so comparing, you know, like looking at these at 7 and 8 as they kind of got up to, I wasn't too impacted by that, going, this is still, you know, attractive. But when, you know, you get used to the 4s, the 3s in some instances, you know, certainly seeing them around that 6 and 7 number or even higher than 7 really does deter the people from going into the marketplace and buying and things. So back in the 90s, you know, the interest rates were at a high number anyway. And the cuts back then, you know, you'd be moving them incrementally. What we've seen, obviously, more recently is they're not incremental movements. These are large movements, and these really impact buyers and sellers throughout, because sellers are sitting on the sideline going, oh my gosh, I can't sell my house because my mortgage payment is too great. This now is going to kind of narrow that gap and maybe get people considering to put their house on the market, which will hopefully increase the inventory too.
With this housing market that's been locked up, I mean, who is more likely to make the first move in this particular situation? Is it the seller, just because they have to go for whatever reason? They're downsizing, they're running out of room, some life change is necessitated selling their house to go elsewhere? Or is it the home buyer saying, let's just do it now and refinance later?
Great question. And I love the thought that, you know, I think that this bubble, as so many people call it, has been just filling and filling with air. Now, something like this, I think it impacts the sellers a little bit more, because, as I just said, it narrows that gap going, okay, it's really not that bad. I'm going from an interest rate that, you know, that I have at maybe 5% to, you know, 6%. Not a tragic adjustment in their financial world, especially if you have to move. The you know, folks refinancing, that spread's got to get to at least a point for it to make sense. Otherwise, they're probably going to kind of hang on a little bit and see, you know, so they'll probably be a little bit later of the market. And then the sellers, I think, would be on the front side of this, because it's, you know, it's closer and quicker for them to realize that gain.
Drew Ischover, founder and owner of the Inspired Title Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today.
Because money matters. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
The Fed rate cut will also have an impact on the auto industry. Let's check in on what this will mean at the dealership with Jeff Gilbert, CBS News automotive reporter based in Detroit. Jeff, thank you for joining us today. And this is an interesting time for the auto industry, Jeff, because it seems like only very recently it got its legs under the supply chain crisis and actually began producing cars with regularity. And now you have an interest rate cut that could push some buyers off the sidelines and into dealerships.
Yeah, and the interest rate cut does more than the obvious. I mean, obviously, it'll cut you know, what somebody pays on a car loan, but it also allows car makers to borrow money and dealers to borrow money that can be used for incentives. So it would allow possibly more of those zero and ultra low interest deals. And the other thing that it does is it opens up financing to more people. There were some people who couldn't get credit. So when interest rates fall, that opens up that pool of potential buyers.
Now, we had been talking about how the pendulum was shifting as far as leverage was concerned back to the buyer from the car dealers during that supply chain crunch. With more people going inside the dealership doors and kicking the tires on various models, does that put the seller back? Does that give them the advantage once again?
Not quite the advantage, but certainly a lot less of a disadvantage. You're likely going to see a few more incentives, and you're seeing the sales mix shift. Some of the people who had wanted to buy more traditional midsize SUVs, things of that nature, had sat things out because there wasn't much of a supply, the prices were high. They're back in the market, so the market is shifting more toward the conventional vehicle and away from what we saw a couple of years ago when it was higher-priced, fully loaded vehicles.
And when we talk about who is able to come into the market once again, the customer who is able to get credit now in this particular interest rate environment, we talked about, you mentioned the more kind of standard vehicles, but the economy, the lower end of the pricing scale, would that see more demand here?
It likely will see more demand, but realize there isn't much of a lower end anymore. You can't find anything for under $20,000. So it's more smaller, midsize SUVs. Those are the vehicles that are becoming more and more in demand.
And then I don't know how often this happens, but is there brisk refinance activity on the part of some people who do take out car loans at higher interest rates and then may be inclined to renegotiate that loan if interest rates fall by one percentage point by early next year?
That is a really interesting question, and I wish I could answer it. I have not really thought about that, so I'm going to have to take a pass on that one.
Hey, maybe it just doesn't happen all that much, but you don't know until you see the data. And then, as far as making sure that the car companies can keep up with this demand, are they able to do so? I mean, is it possible we could see some idled plants or more production lines or more shifts be added to potentially meet this demand?
At this particular point, no, because the assembly lines are keeping up with things, and inventories have recovered, but they're not overly bloated. So we're not likely to see that, with one certain exception, Stellantis, the company that has Jeep, Dodge, Ram. They tend to have higher inventories than most, and they've been cutting back some production to try to trim some of that demand. So they're kind of an outlier here, but industry as a whole pretty much has inventories where they want them, at least right now.
Jeff Gilbert, CBS News automotive correspondent based in Detroit, thank you for joining us today. Still ahead in Technology Thursday, what you need to know about the use of artificial intelligence by young people, including on the homework front.
This is Chicago's news, traffic, and weather station, News Radio 105.9. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Relatives of a murdered Chicago police officer got support from others in the same heartbreaking position. More electronic device explosions in Lebanon have the country on edge. In Technology Thursday, the use of artificial intelligence by kids is rising exponentially, but many parents aren't aware of it. And more companies are offering sabbaticals to help burned-out employees. WBBM Business, the markets are higher. The Dow is up 582 points, the NASDAQ up 499, and the S&P 500 up 106. 86 degrees right now in Chicago under mostly sunny skies. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Chicago Police Officer Luis Huesca has been honored with the addition of his name to the department's memorial wall. He was shot and killed in the Gage Park neighborhood this past April while returning home from his shift. Dion Moon is the mother of the fellow fallen member of the force, Officer Arietta Preston. She spoke at a ceremony yesterday.
But please know that my family and the entire Gold Star and Memorial Foundation stand beside you.
The CPD Gold Star Families Memorial is located east of Soldier Field along the Chicago lakefront. Exploding communications devices targeting Hezbollah members in Lebanon are riling the entire population of the country. The BBC's Hugo Bachega reports from Beirut.
There's also a lot of anger across the country because of the extent of these attacks. Some of these explosions happened as people were shopping, as people were home with their families. So there is shock, but there's also a lot of anger.
The death toll from the mini blasts is reported to be 32. More than 3,000 others have been wounded. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are higher. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist with Murphy and Sylvester in Chicago. Paul, thank you for joining us today. And normally the investors need a good night's sleep to really think about what the chair of the Federal Reserve has to say at the end of a Fed policy meeting during that news conference. And of course, we had the market roller coaster yesterday after the initial interest rate cut announcement. But clearly, in the light of a new day, they like what they see.
They do on the equity side, absolutely. Fixed income investors, not so much. They took back some of the gains from the last week or so. And it's, what's interesting is, obviously, the equity market has been anticipating, expecting that the Fed was going to cut rates. The discussion was really around 25 or 50. We got 50. But Powell said that the economy is still doing well. And I think that's what has really heartened investors and saying, okay, the economy is doing well. The cost of money has come down a little bit. We feel comfortable getting out and buying stocks here.
And on top of that, even with the 50 basis point cut, the half a percentage point cut, interest rates are still in restrictive territory.
Well, you know, again, when you talk about restrictive, if you say, okay, inflation's at 2%, usually you're going to get 1.5 to 2% more than that for bonds. So now you're talking about 4%, you know, maybe 3.5% in bonds. We're there. So we're not too terribly far away from that, especially on the 10-year bond. And that has come down dramatically over the last 3 to 6 months or so. So what's happening now is we're starting to see a normalization of the yield curve. You're starting to see shorter-term rates lower than longer-term rates. We've been 2 years where short rates were above long-term rates. So then it's starting to normalize. And financial stresses, those really are not existent in the marketplace today. So I'm not so sure with the market at all-time highs that we're seeing the stresses that we would normally see when the Fed cuts by 50 basis points.
It also seems there's a little more confidence returning to the job market as well. There was that wobble a couple of weeks ago with that one employment report, but strong numbers in the applications for first-time unemployment benefits this week. 86 degrees right now in Chicago under mostly sunny skies. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Chicago Police Officer Luis Huesca has been honored with the addition of his name to the department's memorial wall. He was shot and killed in the Gage Park neighborhood this past April while returning home from his shift. Dion Moon is the mother of a fellow fallen member of the force, Officer Arietta Preston. She spoke at a ceremony yesterday.
But please know that my family and the entire Gold Star and Memorial Foundation stand beside you.
The CPD Gold Star Families Memorial is located east of Soldier Field along the Chicago lakefront. Exploding communications devices targeting Hezbollah members in Lebanon are riling the entire population of the country. The BBC's Hugo Bachega reports from Beirut.
There's also a lot of anger across the country because of the extent of these attacks. Some of these explosions happened as people were shopping, as people were home with their families. So there is shock, but there's also a lot of anger.
The death toll from the mini blasts is reported to be 32. More than 3,000 others have been wounded. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are higher. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist with Murphy and Sylvester in Chicago. Paul, thank you for joining us today. And normally the investors need a good night's sleep to really think about what the chair of the Federal Reserve has to say at the end of a Fed policy meeting during that news conference. And of course, we had the market roller coaster yesterday after the initial interest rate cut announcement. But clearly, in the light of a new day, they like what they see.
They do on the equity side, absolutely. Fixed income investors, not so much. They took back some of the gains from the last week or so. And it's, what's interesting is obviously the equity market has been anticipating, expecting that the Fed was going to cut rates. The discussion was really around 25 or 50. We got 50. But Powell said that the economy is still doing well. And I think that's what has really heartened investors in saying, okay, the economy is doing well. The cost of money has come down a little bit. We feel comfortable getting out and buying stocks here.
And on top of that, even with the 50 basis point cut, the half a percentage point cut, interest rates are still in restrictive territory.
Well, you know, again, when you talk about restrictive, if you say, okay, inflation's at 2%, usually you're going to get 1.5 to 2% more than that for bonds. So now you're talking about 4%, you know, maybe 3.5% in bonds. We're there. So we're not too terribly far away from that, especially on the 10-year bond. And that has come down dramatically over the last 3 to 6 months or so. So what's happening now is we're starting to see a normalization of the yield curve. You're starting to see shorter-term rates lower than longer-term rates. We've been 2 years where short rates were above long-term rates. So then it's starting to normalize. And financial stresses, those really are not existent in the marketplace today. So I'm not so sure with the market at all-time highs that we're seeing the stresses that we would normally see when the Fed cuts by 50 basis points.
It also seems there's a little more confidence returning to the job market as well. There was that wobble a couple of weeks ago with that one employment report, but strong numbers in the applications for first-time unemployment benefits this week.
Yeah, no, and that's what I said. When you look at what the Fed is, the comments from yesterday and what the Fed has been watching, they're fairly comfortable that inflation is going to get down to that 2% level. They're much more concerned about the jobs market in the direction of monthly new non-farm payroll jobs has been coming down. And I think that's part of the reason why the Fed has decided to cut rates is we're going to do it now in anticipation that things, if we don't do anything, will continue to deteriorate. So they're taking out, if you will, an insurance policy on the fact that maybe we can stem that and we get job growth in that 100 to maybe 130,000 new jobs every month. And that steady state is going to be very good for the economy.
Paul Nolte, Senior Wealth Advisor and Market Strategist, Murphy & Silvest in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, tracking the rapidly growing use of AI by kids, including with their schoolwork.
Your best stock option. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's Technology Thursday. Many parents are likely unaware just how much their children are exposed to and are using artificial intelligence in schools and to do their homework. Let's discuss the growth with Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com in San Francisco. Ina, thank you for joining us today. And the history, kids have been using technology to cheat or cut corners on homework as long as there has been technology and homework. I'm thinking back to kids using calculators to finish their math homework, and I learned a very valuable lesson back when I was in second or third grade, and that was I used the summary on the dust jacket of a book as the substitute for a book report, and the teacher said, "Who are you kidding?" Especially since I wrote it word for word, and it actually said, "Find out inside." So a lesson learned there, and I never did it again. So, but now it's getting more sophisticated, and the technology that kids are using today is leaps and bounds beyond the old TI-86 graphing calculator.
Exactly, Rob. And, you know, this is something schools are having to confront, especially at the high school and college level. It's something parents are having to deal with. And as you point out, there's often a gap between how much parents think their kids are using this technology and how much they are. It's also one that hits close to home. I have a kid that just started sixth grade, middle school, and, you know, asked, "Can I download ChatGPT?" And I said, "Eventually, but we're going to have a conversation first around what we can and can't do with the technology." This technology could do all your homework for you, but that's also not okay. I think there is a place for chatbots in education. I think the idea that we're going to ban it is as naive as the idea of banning calculators. But I do think because it's so powerful, we're also going to have to come up with a set of guidelines of what is appropriate use of the technology in conjunction with learning and what isn't.
And we've been talking about the use of AI in the context of cheating on your homework, but I would imagine more and more schools are incorporating ChatGPT or chatbots or AI into their STEAM curriculum, because that's just the way of the world today, and that the kids who are in school today, who are in fourth or fifth grade, that's going to be a part of their life going forward for the rest of their life.
For sure. And I think if we don't incorporate it, we miss out on a tool that may well be helpful at helping kids not just answer their problems or write an essay for them, but look at their work, find the mistakes, talk through how you would solve a similar problem rather than answering the problem you have. So could very easily see a tool that's built for education that you put in your math problem and it doesn't answer that problem for you. What it does is create a similar problem and walk you through how you'd answer it. So I think there's a lot of potential here. I think there's also going to be a very bumpy period right now, particularly because there aren't very good tools to detect what was written by ChatGPT or another AI tool. They're very imprecise. So what we see happening today is a lot of AI use goes undetected, and then other kids get called out for using AI who weren't using AI.
And then this is something that a lot of teachers are telling me, and that is if you have not encountered a student at this point that has used AI to try to do their homework, you haven't been teaching all that long. It's just a fact of life in the classroom right now. And as you point out, it can be kind of inconsistent in finding out who is using ChatGPT and then who is utilizing their own efforts and their own skills. As a parent, though, are there things you can do? How can you spot the signs of AI use amongst your children?
I mean, the biggest thing I'd recommend, and I've talked to experts about it, and we're going to do this the same in our household, is use the tools with your kids. So sit down with them, let them guide the queries. What are they interested in? If they're interested in basketball, ask basketball questions. But sit down so that you work together with how these tools work, and then have a conversation about what is and isn't okay. So I do think there's a place, but that place is not, here's the assignment, write me an essay. But I think the biggest thing you can do is use the technology with your kids.
Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today, and join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, more burned out employees are taking sabbaticals.
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Some companies are helping out burned out workers by offering them sabbaticals. Let's discuss the benefits and the cost with Jason Wachtel, Managing Partner, J.W. Michaels and Company in Chicago. Jason, thank you for joining us today. And the idea of an employee sabbatical is nothing new. Has it really gained a great deal of traction, though, coming out of the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic?
It's a great question. I would say pre-COVID, at J.W. Michaels, we never really heard of many candidates at all going on sabbatical. But as you pointed out, post-COVID, it's definitely happening much more often. I wouldn't say it's a common thing, but I think many people are taking advantage of companies trying to be fairer to their employees taking more seriously their mental health or bettering themselves from an educational standpoint or trying to be there with their family. So it is more common now. It's still not that common, but it's a hell of a lot more common than it was pre-COVID.
Now, you do have, I don't know if this would count as a sabbatical, but there are companies that do offer parental leave benefits. You can take a month off or 6 weeks off after the birth of a child. Would that qualify as a sabbatical, or is it something else, just taking time off, a couple of weeks off, maybe a month off to recharge?
Yeah, well, I think parental leave is much more common, whether it's the father, the mother, or the other, or the partner. It's definitely much more common for both guardians to take to take parental leave. However, I think sabbatical is different. Generally, it's not necessarily just a month. We're seeing sabbaticals being a year. When we see them, it's never usually a month or two. It's usually 6 months to a year. So I'd say I wouldn't put the parental like a newborn child, but I do think it is common if something happens in a family where someone takes a sabbatical to spend more time with their family. But the timing is usually 6 months to a year from what we've seen at J.W. Michaels.
Now, is this a paid sabbatical, or do you have to negotiate compensation if you're going to take a year off?
You know, it's a great question. It really depends to me on the size of the company. For example, an Amazon, Apple, or Google might pay you for at least part of it or a certain percentage of your compensation for that. Most companies, most mid-sized to smaller companies, they may offer sabbatical, but the only thing they're going to offer you is a guaranteed job when you come back. But generally, it's not going to be a paid tenure, whether it's 6 months or a year.
Now, this sounds like something that if you have a good relationship with your supervisor to even broach the subject to begin with. And then there's probably a great deal of planning and negotiation that goes into how this is going to work, how your work is going to be assigned, and what's going to be expected of you when you come back.
Exactly. This isn't something you come in on a Friday afternoon and tell your boss you're taking a 6 month to a year sabbatical the following Monday. I would agree with you that it's probably months of planning, letting your boss know, bosses know what you're planning on doing, the time frame, and again, who's going to help absorb the jobs that you do and spread it amongst your peers. But yeah, this isn't like I'm letting your boss know the day before you do it. Generally, it's planned out a few months in advance.
And then lastly, is this a practice that you think is going to stick around for a while, or maybe it'll go back out to sea now that more companies are requiring their workers to be back in the office 5 days a week?
You know, it's definitely still not a super popular thing, but it's obviously more popular now than it was pre-COVID, and I think that's going to continue. I think, yes, companies like Amazon are now requiring people to come back 5 days a week, I think starting after the new year, but I think people have definitely been more more supportive of people's sort of home life or personal life. So I do think it's probably going to become a little bit more common. It definitely will be more common than it was pre-COVID, regardless of people going back to work 5 days a week.
Jason Wachtel, Managing Partner, J.W. Michaels & Company in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.
You have. So could very easily see a tool that's built for education that you put in your math problem, and it doesn't answer that problem for you. What it does is create a similar problem and walk you through how you'd answer it. So I think there's a lot of potential here. I think there's also going to be a very bumpy period right now, particularly because there aren't very good tools to detect what was written by ChatGPT or another AI tool. They're very imprecise. So what we see happening today is a lot of AI use goes undetected, and then other kids get called out for using AI who weren't using AI.
And then this is something that a lot of teachers are telling me, and that is if you have not encountered a student at this point that has used AI to try to do their homework, you haven't been teaching all that long. It's just a fact of life in the classroom right now. And as you point out, it can be kind of inconsistent in finding out who is using ChatGPT and then who is utilizing their own efforts and their own skills. As a parent, though, are there things you can do? How can you spot the signs of AI use amongst your children?
I mean, the biggest thing I'd recommend, and I've talked to experts about it, and we're going to do this the same in our household, is use the tools with your kids. So sit down with them, let them guide the queries. What are they interested in? If they're interested in basketball, ask basketball questions. But sit down so that you work together with how these tools work, and then have a conversation about what is and isn't okay. So I do think there's a place, but that place is not, here's the assignment, write me an essay. But I think the biggest thing you can do is use the technology with your kids.
Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for the news site Axios.com in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today, and join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, more burned out employees are taking sabbaticals.
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Some companies are helping out burned out workers by offering them sabbaticals. Let's discuss the benefits and the cost with Jason Wachtel, managing partner, J.W. Michaels & Company in Chicago. Jason, thank you for joining us today. And the idea of an employee sabbatical is nothing new. Has it really gained a great deal of traction, though, coming out of the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic?
It's a great question. I would say pre-COVID, at J.W. Michaels, we never really heard of many candidates at all going on sabbatical. But as you pointed out, post-COVID, it's definitely happening much more often. I wouldn't say it's a common thing, but I think many people are taking advantage of companies trying to be fairer to their employees, employees taking seriously, more seriously, their mental health or bettering themselves from an educational standpoint or trying to be there with their family. So it is more common now. It's still not that common, but it's a hell of a lot more common than it was pre-COVID.
Now, you do have, I don't know if this would count as a sabbatical, but there are companies that do offer parental leave benefits. You can take a month off or 6 weeks off after the birth of a child. Would that qualify as a sabbatical, or is it something else, just taking time off, a couple of weeks off, maybe a month off to recharge?
Yeah, well, I think parental leave is much more common, whether it's the father, the mother, or the other, or the partner. It's definitely much more common for both guardians to take parental leave. However, I think sabbatical is different. Generally, it's not necessarily just a month. We're seeing sabbaticals being a year. When we see them, it's never usually a month or two. It's usually 6 months to a year. So I'd say I wouldn't put the parental like a newborn child, but I do think it is common if something happens in a family where someone takes a sabbatical to spend more time with their family. But the timing is usually 6 months to a year from what we've seen at J.W. Michaels.
Now, is this a paid sabbatical, or do you have to negotiate compensation if you're going to take a year off?
You know, it's a great question. It really depends to me on the size of the company. For example, an Amazon, Apple, or Google might pay you for at least part of it or a certain percentage of your compensation for that. Most companies, most mid-sized to smaller companies, they may offer sabbatical, but the only thing they're going to offer you is a guaranteed job when you come back. But generally, it's not going to be a paid tenure, whether it's 6 months or a year.
Now, this sounds like something that if you have to probably have a good relationship with your supervisor to even broach the subject to begin with. And then there's probably a great deal of planning and negotiation that goes into how this is going to work, how your work is going to be assigned, and what's going to be expected of you when you come back.
Exactly. This isn't something you come in on a Friday afternoon and tell your boss you're taking a 6 month to a year sabbatical the following Monday. I would agree with you that it's probably months of planning, letting your boss know, bosses know what you're planning on doing, the time frame, and again, who's going to help absorb the jobs that you do and spread it amongst your peers. But yeah, this isn't like I'm letting your boss know what the day before you do it. Generally, it's planned out a few months in advance.
And then lastly, is this a practice that you think is going to stick around for a while, or maybe it'll go back out to sea now that more companies are requiring their workers to be back in the office 5 days a week?
You know, it's definitely still not a super popular thing, but it's obviously more popular now than it was pre-COVID, and I think that's going to continue. I think, yes, companies like Amazon are now requiring people to come back 5 days a week, I think starting after the new year, but I think people have definitely been more supportive of people's sort of home life or personal life. So I do think it's probably going to become a little bit more common. It definitely will be more common than it was pre-COVID, regardless of people going back to work 5 days a week.
Jason Wachtel, managing partner, J.W. Michaels & Company in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.